Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with AIB, offering Irish businesses practical knowledge and support to become more sustainable. AIB, for the life you're after.
Well, now a warning that our next item is not suitable for little ears and will contain mention of domestic and sexual violence. 2024 saw a number of high-profile criminal and civil cases that all had one thing in common: the victim was a woman. We may have had an increase in media attention with the number of victims in cases waiving their rights to anonymity throughout the past year, but the fact of the matter is the issue of violence against women remains a significantly prevalent problem in Ireland. Now, to talk about this and what can be done about it, I'm joined by Sarah Benson, CEO of Women's Aid, and by Frank Graney, our courts correspondent, is on the line. Good morning and welcome. Now, Sarah, first of all, it is prevalent. Are we just hearing about it more, or is there an increase?
Well, good morning to your listeners. I think it's certainly the case that the prevalence is not decreasing by any metric that we have. We have lacked good data in relation to domestic and sexual violence historically, but in recent years we have had new reports, both in Ireland through the CSO in terms of sexual violence. We have a new Eurostat Fundamental Rights Agency report on violence against women in Europe. And what that shows us is that in the context of just the work specifically Women's Aid do, which is around intimate partner abuse, is that one in four women will suffer some form of sexual abuse from a partner. And 35% of women in Ireland experience either psychological, sexual or physical abuse from a partner.
Mm. Now, how the accuracy of this kind of statistic, it seems very high. 25% of all women suffer sexual violence or some sort of intimidation by their partner. That's one in four. Look at a row of houses, and one in four of those houses inside is a woman who is being terrorised by her partner.
Yeah, and look, that CSO data is remarkably detailed. It was a years-long piece of work. And in fact, our hope now is that there will be a repeat survey for Ireland conducted by the CSO on intimate partner abuse. It was very detailed. They released it in four separate tranches. So much information was involved. Unfortunately, I mean, we need to be clear that the definition of sexual abuse has a spectrum to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it ranges from, you know, touching straight through to the act of rape. So everything is in that. And so it is, of course, important to look at definitions. However, we do also know from that Eurostat report that I mentioned that we have very high levels of reported sexual abuse across the board, not just from intimate partners, by Irish women and particularly younger women. So I think...
Are we very different to the rest of Europe?
That data was released just at the end of November, and we're still looking at it. But in respect of intimate partner abuse, we are kind of in the comparative area. But the sexual abuse statistic appears to be higher. And so we'll be doing some work ourselves to look at understanding why that is. I do think at the same time, though, that, you know, we have been very silent and stigmatizing of this issue for so many years. And there has been a definitive change in the public conversation, in the openness to discussing. Really important work in areas like consent have been trailblazing over only the last 10 years. And I do think that that is encouraging people to speak out, including, as you mentioned, some of those who have waived their anonymity in criminal proceedings.
Now, we'll talk to Frank in a moment about the cases that actually get to court and what he witnesses. But in terms of your own work at the Coalface and Women's Aid, you know, what is it? In 2023, 2,600. But in the context of the entire female population, that's relatively small. So it suggests, although that number should not be high at all, it should be much lower than that, it suggests that most people aren't complaining.
Well, what I would say is Women's Aid is a national service. We run a national helpline, a high-risk support project and a range of advocacy campaigning and awareness campaigns. Our national helpline, and I might just pause to share the number because this particular segment may bring things up for people, is 1-800-341-900. Our statistics reflect Women's Aid's direct work. We refer to our, you know, 30-plus colleagues in the local services and refuges around the country. We also refer to the rape crisis centres all around the country. Our data is just the Women's Aid data. Our colleagues across the country every day right now are meeting and hearing from survivors of both domestic and sexual violence. And we also know, which is again borne out by that Eurostat report, is that those who reach out to specialist services for support are just the tip of the iceberg. Mm. And that's why it is so important to have a community response and recognition of this.
Therefore, what I suggested to you, even though the numbers are higher than the numbers just contacting Women's Aid, there are many people who suffer in silence.
Absolutely. We, through our own research, have found that women of all ages, about 30% will tell nobody. And we also have research conducted specifically with younger people and younger women in particular. Again, about a third will tell nobody. And that is chilling. But what we do know is that if they do tell somebody, for younger people, it's more likely to be a peer. It may be a family member. It may even be an employer. And that's why measures such as having our paid domestic violence leave on a statutory basis here. That's why awareness campaigns, not just to raise awareness of support services that are available, and they are available, but also to raise awareness of what coercive control is, what consent is, are so important, so that victim survivors feel confident to speak out. And we also know that they need to be invited to share, because it's terrifying, the idea that they may not be believed or that they may be stigmatised for something that was not their fault.
Now, in the main and the huge majority of cases, it's the perpetration of this violence by men on women. There are some women who also perpetrate, but they're so tiny they don't really form part of our discussion. But men should, in terms as perpetrators, what do we know about the attitudes of men?
Well, and certainly just to acknowledge that abuse can happen, towards men as well, and also in LGBT relationships. And again, the National Helpline, our helpline, will signpost to the likes of the Men's Development Network, Male Advice Line and other relevant support services. So again, just to say there should be support there for everybody. But we are talking specifically about a very gendered issue, very gendered crimes. It is male violence against women. What I would also say is the vast majority of violence against men is perpetrated by men. And so this work to end male violence against women is also the work to end male violence against men. Mm.
The stats about men, 70% believe women's issues are exaggerated. Two in five men hold what are called traditional views.
Yes, this refers...
Like the place of the woman, etc.
So just to maybe give a little bit more precision, because that alarming 72% figure is among the two in five men in Ireland who would hold much more traditionalist views. This was a report that was produced by CORE, a partner of ours, looking at exploring masculinity and attitudes to masculinity. And it engaged with both male and female members in a nationally representative survey. But the men's responses in particular were of interest. Two in five men hold what we would call those traditionalist views, where they would espouse the view that dominance is the most effective expression and most desirable expression of strength, that expressing vulnerability is a weakness, in complete contrast to the three in five men who would, be much more in tune to, equality, the fact that recognising that there's sexism and that women's issues are
important.
And
do we know
where
those attitudes in that two in five, where those attitudes are coming from?
Well, what was most startling when we published that report in late November of last year was that the majority of that cohort holding those traditionalist views are younger men. And I do think that, that there is that connection to where young men, boys, receive their media, their information, the perhaps outsized influence of online social media platforms and the algorithms within them, which we know from research conducted by DCU on boys engaging with TikTok and YouTube as two examples, is that they are actively dragged into spaces which amplify a sense of male alienation, which direct them towards more misogynistic views, more traditionally held views, which both inhibit equality in relationships, but also inhibit men and boys in exploring a much more authentic self, which is more emotionally connected, which gives them permission to value and to lean into being a young person, a young man, or even an older man, where strength is not where they're defined. External trappings like wealth or being the main breadwinner are not the primary concerns. And those are the concerns of those more traditionalist individuals. And unfortunately, that puts them in direct conflict with measures that might be more trying to explore equality, diversity, and just healthy, respectful relationships that are predicated on mutuality and negotiation, and rather than stereotypical quite sexist roles.
If you go back in time, and I suspect girls were always probably better than the boys in the Leaving Cert, and that is for sure today. But in the past, women, you know, who qualify well, they often came to a full stop when it came to careers, whether they lost a job opportunity because they were female or because when they started a family, they had to interrupt a career. That is less and less so. And do we know whether there's huge resentment building up on the part of young fellas who see the girls getting what they academically deserve?
I think it's really interesting, and when you look objectively at the kind of the status of equality and gender equality in particular across all metrics, we still have a gender unequal society. We are still 95th in the world in respect of our political representation of, say, women in public life. At board level, there is great work being done on gender pay gaps, but they still exist. And we also have huge structural issues that are inherited, which are sexist and patriarchal, where the burden of care work, for example, is very disproportionately held by women. So that is the reality. The glass ceiling is still, to a certain extent, in place. The structures and systems that facilitate women's participation in public life, including fair distribution of care, are still significant issues. But there does appear to be a perception on the part of a cohort of men, but particularly young men, that somehow equality has become tilted the other way. It isn't borne out by fact, but the feeling is clearly there. And I do think that a lot of work has been done to encourage measures around equality and girls and women to reach and stretch into, you know, all of the potential that they have. But we maybe haven't given a message for young boys around why that is also good for them and the fact that they shouldn't be threatened by it.
Joe makes the point, traditional views, that's a shocking way of describing it. Traditionally, most men are very good people. Saying bad men have traditional views is disgusting, and it's the wrong term for it, but it tends to be the term that's being used, say, in America at the moment, for those who would have rather misogynistic views of women.
I actually choose the word traditional quite carefully for the reason that I don't think we should be entering into a binary that is about individual good or bad. We are socialized into a very historically, you know, from time immemorial, quite sexist society. That is a fact, and it is clear. But traditionalist views are the ones that are the historical ones. If I used an alternative term such as toxic masculinity or something like that, I think that that is not a helpful term. So I'm quite deliberately trying to suggest that we have structures and systems here, and we have culture and discourse that needs to support men to be their authentic selves, and not to feel threatened by the fact that women are still not at equality, but that we do, an equal society serves us all better.
Well, now, you're, as I say, giving us the background to all of this. You're at the Coalface. Frank Graney, our courts correspondent, is at the Coalface in another arena, which is the arena of the courts. Frank, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, you see this, you report on it regularly for us and for other programmes on News Talk. And the question we ask is, are matters getting worse in your tenure as courts correspondent? Or is it just that we're hearing more about what has always been going on?
Well, it's a great question, and it's probably a good time to ask me that question, because I've been doing this role now for exactly 10 years, almost to the day. And in my experience, I don't know if we're seeing an upward trend in terms of these cases, because the Central Criminal Court in particular has always been quite busy when it comes to handling rape cases. But over the years, because of identification issues and because of the fact that there are so many of these cases, they simply don't all get reported on. But what we've seen, I think, in recent years is, and the women who come outside court, the survivors of domestic and sexual violence, who come out and are under absolutely no obligation to do so, by the way, but when they come out and waive their anonymity to speak to the gathered media, to send out a message to sometimes name and shame the perpetrator. But what we're seeing is, I suppose, faces put to the stories, names put to the stories. And that's really helpful, I suppose, in engaging the public in these very important conversations. And one recurring theme throughout all of these statements that are made outside court is that the woman standing outside court getting her day of justice, finally, and it does take a long time, and we may speak about that in a moment. But the recurring theme in those statements is that they're doing it to reach out to other survivors of violence who are perhaps sitting at home, living in silence, living with a violent partner, too afraid to come forward for all the reasons that Sarah has just outlined. And they're doing that to help others. And we see that it does work. Just recently, Nikita Hand, after winning her civil legal action against Conor McGregor, she came out and very bravely made a statement in front of the national and international media. Not an easy thing to do. And that was her message. And we heard rape crisis centres reporting in the 6 hours or so afterwards, there was a 150% surge in phone calls made. Now, we don't know if the people making those phone calls go on to report those cases, but certainly that is a very positive silver lining amidst all the horror of what comes before.
Now, murder is the ultimate crime, taking the life of someone away. But in terms of your 10 years, do you see an increasing violence and indeed the nature of sexual violence on people? Is it changing, and is it down to pornography?
I think it's certainly getting worse. You know, anytime I come on to talk to you and your listeners about a case that I'm covering, it's always prefaced with a content warning. But the reality is that as clean as I try to approach these reports, conscious obviously of people listening to them at home, particularly young ears, the reality is that for hours every day while a trial is being held before a jury, the Central Criminal Court, the detail is very, very graphic. A complainant will have to get into the box and explain in great detail what happened to them, and then be subjected to hours, sometimes days, of very difficult cross-examination. And the nature of it, the level of violence I feel that's being meted out, not just when it comes to acts of sexual violence, in other cases too, involving physical violence and murder cases that I've covered over the years, I do feel that what we're seeing is a greater level of violence meted out. I do believe, and this is generally speaking, this is you know, young men who find themselves in the dock accused of these crimes. And I do think that the easy access of things like very graphic pornography online, that they would have easy access to as adolescents, you know, when they are particularly vulnerable to these things, you know, that they are definitely featuring, I feel, in the crimes that are then committed. I'm reminded of a couple of cases that I've covered over the years, just in terms of the level of violence inflicted. Nadine Lott, murdered by her ex, Daniel Murta, in 2019. He was a trained boxer. He beat her so viciously that her mother didn't recognize her when she saw her. A paramedic who gave evidence at that trial broke down when she recalled Nadine's injuries. Lorna Woodnot, more recently, back in 2023, murdered by a teenage boy who used a sledgehammer and a lump hammer to bludgeon her to death in her home down in County Offaly. And Natasha O'Brien, I think we're all very familiar with Natasha's story. She was beaten unconscious on the streets of Limerick for giving out to a then member of the Irish Defence Forces, Cathal Crotty. She was given out to him for using homophobic remarks, and he knocked her unconscious, hit her four times, and later boasted on Snapchat that it took two to put her down, two to put her out. So I think social media, the easy access of certainly when it comes to cases of sexual violence, the easy access for young men to access that online pornography, I think it certainly plays a role in what we're seeing come before the courts.
Now, there was a woman called Blanid Raly, and she was very impactful in what she had to say when she came out of court.
Oh, she absolutely was. And again, it throws back to what I said earlier, putting faces to these stories. And again, you know, these survivors are under absolutely no obligation to do that. It is entirely of their own free will. They do it for lots of different reasons. But as I said, the recurring theme is to help others. And that's exactly what Blanid was doing as well, because she had the experience of, you know, waiting for this case for years. And these cases do take a long time to come to court. And that's perhaps one of the reasons that you feel survivors don't come forward and report their cases, is because, you know, they are on the path to recovery and then their case is called and inevitably they're re-traumatized by it and it can set them back. Many of the women choose not to waive their anonymity for their own personal reasons. They're never, ever pushed to do so by the media. I should say that that's very important to say. In fact, where there's a case, one journalist will approach usually a Garda liaison officer, a solicitor, a member of the family, to see if that person would like to say something outside. More often than not, they choose not to. But we are seeing a trend nowadays where people like Blanid are coming out, because they want to help others. And as I mentioned earlier, I think it's really working. And she was also quite upset, understandably so, that her attacker, the man who raped her, was able to live his life for years with nobody knowing what he had done or what he was accused of doing. Such is the rules in relation to identification of these cases. Not the same in the UK, I should say. Pat, many years ago, you and I covered in great detail the infamous Belfast rape trial, where we were able to identify the accused persons because the rules and the laws in the UK are very different to how we approach cases down here.
Now, she, what Blonde had said was, I'm handing the shame back to you, in other words, to the perpetrator, who is a man called Jonathan Moran of Mullingar. And that kind of was echoed subsequently by Gisèle Pelicot in France, where she waived her anonymity. And we talked to her solicitor, her lawyer, earlier in the week. And her logic was, you know, I would have to sit in court with all these 50 accused sitting opposite me with all their phalanx of lawyers, and I'd be there on my own with my couple of legal people, and they would remain anonymous until the end of the trial. And she thought, no, I'm going to expose them.
Absolutely. And in my experience, what you see is there are many survivors of sexual and domestic violence that almost blame themselves, and they shouldn't, obviously. But they do, and that's again another recurring theme in these cases. And they do feel ashamed, somewhat embarrassed by what happened. And that's again one of the many reasons that a lot of people choose not to come forward and report these cases. So it is absolutely vital that they hand that shame back. And I feel that that's part of the path to recovery as well, is washing themselves of that shame that they should never have felt in the first instance. And in most cases, in my experience in the Central Criminal Court, once a person is convicted, the judge will often tell the survivor of that violence that they are not to blame for what happened and that they shouldn't carry that shame. And indeed, it's always very, very emotional and very powerful when you see them on the steps of the courthouse handing that shame back to where it always belonged.
I have a text here. I'm 60 years of age. I lived in an abusive marriage for 26 years. I had nowhere to turn, nowhere to go. I never reported it to anyone as I felt no one would listen, and I still haven't reported what happened. I think that a lot of women my age put up with a huge amount of abuse and violence, but then hide it. Thankfully, I finally escaped, and there are more services now, and the Gardaí are sympathetic. I wonder, has that been an issue that the Gardaí didn't quite get it in? Do you remember that old line, it's only a domestic? You know, yeah, when the phone in the Garda station rang, oh, it's only a domestic.
Yeah, I know. And look, you know, Garda Síochána are very busy, but they do take these cases very, very seriously nowadays. And I think that's something that can't be said for yesteryear. You know, the texter into the show there is dead right. In fact, isn't it remarkable to think that it wasn't illegal to rape your wife up until only recently? I think in the early 1990s, it was criminalised marital rape, which is extraordinary. And I think, you know, our laws reflect the attitudes of our society at any given time. So I think pre that law being introduced in 1990, I think that goes a long way to how society as a whole viewed marriage and what happened in the marital bedroom. But I have to give great praise to An Garda Síochána in relation to how they approach these cases, investigate these very complicated, complex cases, particularly in relation to a relatively new offence, coercive control as well, which acknowledges the psychological and emotional damage and injuries that can be inflicted on a person. They're very, very difficult cases to investigate. But in my experience, when those cases come before the court and you see day to day the body of work that has gone into them, it's truly remarkable. The Gardaí also have very friendly ears. They have specialist Gardaí units have been established to focus on cases of domestic and sexual violence. Officers specially trained to handle victims with sensitivity. Free victim support services also rolled out by organisations like Women's Aid. So I think, like, whatever about An Garda Síochána of yesteryear, the police force that we have in operation nowadays is a lot more sensitive to these issues.
And that's very reassuring. Back to you, Sarah. The question for many women who are in terrible situations, they often weigh up, and it's a balance. If I walk out of here with my kids and go to a refuge, look for help from Women's Aid or whoever it might be, I lose my home And it's an equation that they actually put their own suffering on hold and put up with it for what they perceive to be the greater good of the family.
Yeah, when we're talking about intimate partner abuse in particular, it is not straightforward. And we strongly encourage people never to kind of start framing the question as why doesn't she leave, but what is keeping her in that situation. And the responsibility in that situation is always on the perpetrator of the abuse. We become very focused on what a victim survivor can do, whereas actually the perpetrator could stop the behaviour. So that's something that we really need to pay attention to. And if you have the complicated situation of an emotionally complex relationship, one where there was love, there was, you know, expectations of, you know, a life together, where there is gaslighting, where there are children in common, where there are financials in common, it isn't straightforward. And that's why we need a multifaceted whole of government response, which is part of the third national strategy, which is at its midpoint. And so now with the formation of government, given that domestic violence is probably the highest call-out issue for An Garda Síochána, that sexual violence and domestic violence permeates all of our communities and has lifelong devastating impacts, including loss of life, we really hope that when it's published at 3 o'clock today, that we see some focus on a continued prioritisation of combating and preventing domestic and sexual violence in our programme for government.
Sarah Benson, CEO of Women's Aid, Frank Graney, our courts correspondent, thank you very much. Now, if you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this discussion, you can contact Women's Aid 24-hour national free phone line on 1-800-341-900 or the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre on 1-800-77-8888.
Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with AIB, offering Irish businesses practical knowledge and support to become more sustainable. AIB, for the life you're after.